KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to the inaugural winter quarter edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining me today on this first show of the quarter. I am very pleased to have on Professor Michael Frumkin of the University of Miami School of Law, who is an active blogger at discourse.net and an expert in, among other areas, internet law. And we are going to be chatting today about a topic that I think is of particular interest to us in the beginning of 2012, the idea of the internet kill switch and internet kill switch legislation that is floating around in Congress. This concept, I think probably I'd say, at least within the last year, gained its highest prominence in the Arab Spring, particularly in Egypt, when Egypt was able to flip the proverbial switch. Although because of Egypt's infrastructure, it was somewhat that simple to turn off the internet during the height of the anti-Mubarak protests. But the internet kill switch idea is something that has its antecedents going back to the development of the modern commercial internet, when people started identifying activities and speech and items and communications that they didn't like, and governments started thinking about how they could quell that activity that is considered undesirable and prevent it from occurring on the internet. So the idea of turning off the internet, of cutting off one's access to it, of shutting down the internet for individuals or entities has been something that has been toyed with and thought about by policymakers, unfortunately in democracies, but certainly in more repressive countries since the dawn of the modern commercial internet. And so today we're going to be chatting about internet kill switch legislation in the United States, its implications, what does it mean, by drilling down on current pending law, current pending bills, I should say, in the United States Congress. And for those listening abroad, Congress has gotten enormous attention, both nationally and internationally recently, and it's ongoing, in connection with the Stop Online Privacy Act, SOPA, in the House of Representatives, and its companion bill, Protect IP, in the Senate, which does not have kill switch legislation in it per se, although it has had in its incarnations language written into it that would allow certain internet access providers and others, or force certain internet access providers and others, to remove domain names from the internet itself. Not as drastic, perhaps, as kill switch per se, but certainly for those impacted websites, there's a similar impact. By way of disclosure, I've been active in writing and opposing those bills. SOPA and PIPA are not a focus of today's show per se, but certainly these ideas of removing entities or content from the internet is something that continues to vex policymakers and also continues to be sought by a variety of entities who seek to control speech in one form or another on the internet for perhaps good reasons and perhaps not. But we're going to explore those issues today with Michael, who, by way of brief background, is the Lori Silvers and Mitchell Rubenstein Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Miami School of Law. He received degrees from both Cambridge University and Yale. He also clerked for Judge Stephen F. Williams of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and for John F. Grady, the Chief Judge in the Northern District of Illinois. He teaches a variety of topics, but focuses heavily on internet law per se, and as I mentioned, is an active blogger as well. Being familiar with Michael's work over several years, but never having actually met Michael, I was thrilled to hear him speak at the recent Association of American Law Schools annual meeting on this very topic, and invited him to be on the show to continue the discussion and to fill in my listeners on this issue. So with that, Michael is joining us via Skype from Florida. Michael, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Hey, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Let's start off with a first question that I ask virtually everyone on the show. Tell me about the genesis of your interest in technology and particularly this issue.
Well, it's a slightly funny story because I was a programmer before I was a lawyer, and I became a programmer, a pretty low-level programmer, kind of by accident. My high school got a computer terminal, which was linked to the other high school that actually had the computer. And you have to understand, they were very proud of this computer because it was the fancy model. It had, you know, 16K, not 8K, like some computers did. And, you know, nobody knew how to use it. So some of us kids sort of just taught ourselves how to program and hacked around. And then I graduated from high school and needed a summer job. And the only job I could find was selling books on houseplants by phone. And I lasted a week at that. And then I, you know, I needed a job, and my parents said, well, you know how to program computers. Maybe somebody will hire you to do that. And that was an amazing idea. It never occurred to me somebody would pay you for that. It was fun. So next thing I knew, I was working for the World Bank. And that's what I did to make money in college. And then the cycle kind of repeated itself. By the time I got to law school, it was just a hobby again. And by the time I got into law teaching, it was definitely just a hobby. I was going to be doing administrative law. But I got an internet account, and I was sort of playing around with this is the pre-graphical, pre-webnet. And one day my wife says to me, you know, you spend too much time on that thing. Either stop playing with it or start writing about it. So I started writing about it. And at the best was just at the time when the Clipper chip was happening, mid-90s. And there were all these engineers online who think they're constitutional law scholars explaining confidently how the Clipper chip was unconstitutional. And that didn't seem quite as obvious to me as I wanted it to be. So I sat down to write a 10-page note that I would, you know, post up explaining to all the engineers how the Constitution worked on this encryption stuff. And one summer later, I had 160 pages in a case of carpal tunnel, and I had my first big internet law article. And it's just, you know, ever since then, it's been one thing has led to the next. It's been an absolutely fascinating ride, all these incredible issues to think about.
Let me, you know, it's funny. Both of us are teaching internet law this semester. I just a few hours ago, this morning, finished and recorded. I should say we're recording the show on January 23rd for airing on January 27th. This morning, I finished my first internet law course of the semester, and the question I left the class with is one that anyone who teaches and writes in internet law thinks about, or indeed the people that legislate and decide these issues as well, lawyers, judges, legislators, and so forth. Which is there internet law, and should there be? And I'm curious, I guess this is a very top-level question, but one that we all think about. And I'll ask you that question, Michael. I mean, is there a field of internet law? And if so, how would you define it?
Well, this is what we in the trade call the law of the horse question, after the famous article by Judge Easterbrook, which he proudly said Chicago does not have a class on the law of the horse, and it shouldn't have a class on the law of the internet either, for the same reason, that it's really, you know, just a technology that cuts across different areas of the law. And time has been kind to Easterbrook's argument. I mean, my own career is an absolute definite, you know, example of that. I mean, I used to hold myself out as an internet lawyer, and that made some sense. I mean, when I started doing this, I read all the articles that had been published about the internet in American law journals in about a week. And I read all zero cases. That was very easy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you couldn't possibly do either of those things, you know, quickly. Now, there are a lot of cases, and there's far more articles than you can keep up with. Meanwhile, internet law has become a subfield of many other things. So if you're going to do sort of internet banking, you need to be a banking lawyer who also understands the internet, rather than an internet lawyer who tries to cobble up some banking. And that's become increasingly true for more and more of the field. So the field, I think, is actually in some ways shrinking. There still are some bits which are distinctly, I think, internet law-like. In IP areas is one area where there's a lot of that, although that's not where I tend to work the most. In privacy law, I think there's a huge area that's still where the internet really is special, and I do work quite a lot in that area. And there's also what I call the regulation of the plumbing, which implicates both free speech and contract and transnational law and all the rest of it. So domain name system issues, free speech issues, those kinds of things.
And let me follow up.
There's less than there was 10 years ago.
Yeah, let me ask you that point, because you mentioned, you said the law of the plumbing, which I'll ask you to explain a little more what you mean by that.
Well, the domain name system is the best example, although the IP numbering system is going to get hot in the next couple of years, I think, as people start fighting over legacy IP allocations and so on. But there are some very specific things that have been created, or virtual things that have been created for internet purposes, where our traditional legal categories have a lot of trouble fitting. And we either have special legislation, or we have special customs, or we have some, you know, things just aren't quite like they are in other circumstances, or it's not obvious they should be treated like other circumstances. And they're special, so they require some sort of special thinking about.
we have with that, and I was interested to ask that question because I think that there, and I agree with your assessment with regard to the field, and yet I think policymakers, to begin our discussion of internet kill switch legislation, still view the internet and do view the internet as something different. It would seem that there is still a view that the internet is its own animal. And I'm curious, as we begin our discussion of internet kill switch legislation, whether A, you agree that that's what's going on, or you have a different view, and B, if you think that matters.
Well, I guess I have a slightly different view. I mean, it seems to me that there's a combination of two things going on in the policy circles. I mean, you have a group of people who, you know, some of whom are sort of, you know, emotionally Luddites, even if not necessarily intellectually, who really find the internet scary. Right? I mean, I almost think when they look at a computer screen, they imagine a hand that's going to reach out and grab them by the throat. They're scary because either no one's in charge, or it's scary because there's all this bad stuff happening out there and you don't know where it is, and it's secret, and it's conspiracy, and it's terrorism, and it's awful, it's drugs, it's pedophiles, whatever it might be. Tim May's Four Horsemen, whatever. That's one group. And you have another group of people, who some of whom are absolutely definitely not Luddite at all, but who understand that the threat that the internet imposes to their business model. And not all these people are business people. Right? Some of them are government people who are used to doing, say, you know, police investigations in a particular kind of way, and then all of a sudden all the data is going to be encrypted. So you have got, you know, a way of life which is comfortable and works for them, which is now being destabilized. So I think we have an alliance often between those groups who are both for different reasons unhappy about a proposed, you know, likely change and want to control it in some way. And then, of course, there's a third group of people who are very technologically savvy and see distinct dangers and threats and want to deal with it in traditional ways, which is to, you know, make sure that governments have the tools it takes to do the traditional things they do, promote public safety, national wealth, and so on.
Now, the presentation, get into kill switch now, the presentation I saw at the ALS, and again, for those who aren't law professors, the ALS is the umbrella organization that most law schools in the United States belong to, and they have an annual conference and other conferences where law professors get together and talk about each other's work and so forth. The presentation that I saw you present at the ALS earlier this month, Michael, was entitled Kill Switch or Bait and Switch. And so let's start our discussion really with by defining terms, because your goal in the presentation was to take the proposal seriously as opposed to dismissing it outright for reasons we can also talk about.
But that's right. I mean, it was funny when I started doing the topic was actually picked by the organizers of the conference who were kind enough to invite me. So I sat down to really educate myself about it, and what I discovered was two things. First off, that the kill switch term was a brilliant piece of marketing by the critics, mm-hmm. and that there was a lot more going on in the bill than the kill switch piece, or the kill switch being this idea you push some button and the internet stops. It's not quite exactly how this turns out to work, if it ever became law. And the other thing I discovered, which really surprised me actually, was that nobody that I could find, at least, had sat down and really written an analysis of what the bill was trying to do or why. I mean, I had imagined I'd go out and find somebody else's work, build on that, and talk about whether it was a good idea or not. But as is so often the case, this internet stuff moves so fast, a lot of the basic work doesn't get done. And I've never been able to resist that work when it needs doing. And it's been very much my style in writing in the past, is you've got to have the foundations. I think you both, just as I want policymakers to have good technological foundations when they regulate, I want activists, and I'm sometimes one of them myself, to have a clear understanding of what the legal stakes are and what's going on, you know, what the legal rules applicable are before they go out and try to agitate. So that's what I was trying to do here. What are these people doing? Why are they doing it?
And that leads to that question. So you've already said that kill switch is a brilliant turn of phrase from the critics. What does kill switch mean, and what phrase would you use if not that one?
Well, it has a piece of truth in it. I mean, but what they really want to do probably is have a whole bank of switches rather than one big kill switch, right? If I was going to use a more accurate metaphor, it's they really want to have a whole bunch of switches that they can flip in fairly fine-grained ways to deal with a whole bunch of hypothesized threats. Interestingly, right now, the kill switch authority already exists. There's this thing called Section 07 of the Communications Act, which actually gives, it's World War II era statute that's never been repealed, that gives the federal government the ability to shut down communication services, basically, in a national emergency like a state of war. But the trouble is that from the point of view of the people proposing these bills, and that's primarily Senators Lieberman and Collins, but also others, is that that's kind of all or nothing. It's one big switch. When really what they want to do is target whatever they think is a problem. And one of the things I learned at that conference we went to in Washington, one of the other speakers, was another thing they're probably trying to do is motivate some of the folks who own these infrastructures to invest more in security, or really not motivate them by requiring them. So the model they may be working on is they have some idea of what the threats are, and we can discuss to what extent those threats are realistic. I think it varies. It's not, the answers vary depending on what the threat is. And in some cases, they're concerned that people who would be vulnerable to some of these threats have no particular incentive to invest to stop them or under-investing, because after all, investing in security is not a profit center. So they want the authority to basically dream up scenarios, and that's what this bill allows them to do, dream up scenarios, create plans that would deal with the scenarios that they imagine, and then force the various companies in the what they consider critical infrastructure industries to implement those plans, to be ready, spending private money to do it, interestingly, which has, some interesting implications about unfunded mandates and the rest of it. But so they really want to regulate companies engaged in electricity provision, lots of other things, to be prepared for the things which the government decides they need to be prepared for, not for the things that the firms, using whatever maximizing function they're using themselves, have decided they want to be prepared for.
Now, when we let's be clear about a few basic things. When we say kill, what are we killing exactly in this bill?
Well, the bill does not define a list of things that have to be killed. What it does is it tries to set up new agencies with new powers, which are the power basically to write these contingency plans, and then to some extent with industry input, refine the contingency plans. And then by regulation require the industry to do what it would take to be able to deal with the contingency, including turning off whatever it is that might be turned off. But it might be other things as well. And that's where the killing comes in, right? So the hypothesis is all of a sudden some threat, terrorist, foreign, whatever it might be, is occurring, taking advantage of some heretofore unsuspected vulnerability in our infrastructure. And I'll go into more details about that in a bit. And is there a way we can block that? Well, if we built the equipment in a way which is designed to allow us to do that, we can block it in some way that might be more fine-grained than just pulling the plug on everything and then waiting to rebuild it. That's the hope, I think, that that's motivating these bills.
And that gets us to some of those issues. But before I get there, though, just again by way of background, who is sponsoring the bills, and what's the current status in Congress?
Well, Lieberman and Collins are behind the Senate versions, which are the ones I looked at most carefully. There's a companion House version for one of them. There's a bunch of different versions of this. So the most recent that I know of was early last year, almost 12 months ago.
I see.
The language is, in all these different versions, is pretty similar, although not identical. They've been refining as they go along. And we haven't heard much about it in the last 6 months. And that suggests that it's sleeping. I mean, I think part of it is SOPA, and, which you mentioned before, SOPA and PIPA sucked up a lot of the oxygen for this stuff. But this is the kind of bill that hangs around and waits to be attached to something. So, it's sort of, drafted nearly ready to go. So one could imagine it being revived. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Senator Lieberman's term, at least, is coming to an end. So if he doesn't get it done before he leaves, some of the force may go out of this.
With regard to the contours of the current bill, I think a good overview, you start to get into it, would be useful. So tell us what the key provisions are, and particularly the enforcement provisions as well. But again, to get exactly to that follow-up question, what's being killed?
The structure is in some ways quite classic, right? You empower an agency to figure out what a problem is. You empower them to write regs requiring that private sector deal with the problem. In this case, the authority is contingency in two ways. First off, the firms build whatever it is that they're told to build by these regulations that would deal with the expected problems. And then if the president declares a state of cyber emergency, then the contingency plans spring into effect and the firms are required to implement them. Now, the tricky parts are that in the first step, right, when they're drafting the contingency plans, it looks like the firms will have a fair amount of ability to contest what the government's requiring them to do. It's not quite a negotiation, but it's more like a traditional regulation sort of idea where there's some back and forth between the agency and the regulator. Where the uncontestable part comes is if the president declares the cyber emergency. As the bills are currently drafted, that finding is intended to be unreviewable. And that is, again, you know, the issue of presidential declarations is a tough area in separation of powers, where there hasn't been an enormous amount of case law. And what there has been is tend to be pretty favorable to the president, right? The Supreme Court is very reluctant to say that presidential, direct presidential decisions, as opposed to those of, say, a cabinet secretary or another underling, would be very would be directly reviewable. There's been a great deal of controversy in legal circles about trying to arrange something that'll be unreviewable because everybody's thinking about Youngstown, right? And this situation is different from Youngstown. Youngstown is a classic case which you always go back to in these sort of emergency separation of powers kind of situations, where during the Korean War, President Truman tried to seize some American industry in order to get tanks built for the Korean War. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. But one of the reasons they gave for why he couldn't do that was Congress had legislated either in a way which made it, which prevented it, or at the very least failed to help it. This situation, if this bill were to pass, would be completely different in two ways. First off, Congress would have approved it, so the presidency would be at its strongest. Second, the Congress would have created direct presidential authority to make this declaration. So we're in a gray area of constitutional law here, but one where the presidency would have a pretty good argument. It's very tough, especially if it turned out they were right about the facts. It's pretty tough to imagine the Supreme Court saying, you know, yes, you dealt with a situation where, say, a foreign power was trying to send pings of death to the United States. I'll explain what that is in a sec. You know, trying to do something terrible to our infrastructure. And what you did some good, and now we're going to punish you for it. It's not that likely. So although it's an ugly precedent, it's one that might actually work.
When we think
now,
about
let me say a few words, if I may, about what are the threat models that
sure.
I think drive this.
And, before you do that, Mike, let me just say that you're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford, and we're chatting with Professor Michael Frumkin of the University of Miami School of Law. Michael, please continue.
Okay, so that's, you know, what motivates this legislation is the idea that it's a really scary world out there. And I got to say that, you know, I want to be clear, I think there's an element of truth to this. I mean, I think reasonable people could argue about how scary it is and how likely some of these scenarios are. But many of these things are based on things that have actually happened on at least a small scale already. Right? So we're not talking just about things like internet worms. So we've had the Morris worm and the Stuxnet worm, right? This apparently targeted, some government crafted, targeted worm that went after centrifuges that were able to separate out nuclear weapons-grade material. We're familiar with what are known as DDoS attacks, right? Which is when you get a botnet or something, you get a whole bunch of people doing a distributed denial of service. So they're sending data from so many different places so fast that they bring a network to its knees. That's a real threat. It's unfortunate for me, I think, that the people supporting this bill have taken something that's genuine, real, and potentially quite scary and exaggerated enormously just how bad it is by throwing up a bunch of statistics that. And one statistic that I saw used in favor of this bill was that the executive branch in Congress under cyber attack, an average of 1.8 billion times per month. Now, I'm certain that they calculate that the same way the Pentagon calculates cyber attacks, which is every mistyped URL is seen as an attempt to get something you weren't entitled to have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that will be every attempt to access a web page and got a not found or not authorized, mistyped password, everything. So, you know, those are real dangers without exaggerating. Another thing that can be quite scary and perhaps isn't as well known is attacks or potential attacks on critical infrastructure by terrorists or foreign powers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a power grid, which has a lot now of distributed intelligence at the edges of the network.
And what is distributed intelligence?
Sorry?
What is distributed intelligence?
Oh, it's when you put some sort of smart chip or some sort of intelligent control system, say in the substation. Right, so now all the controls aren't entirely, all the computing power isn't entirely at the center. It's also at the edges to help, you know, control things and to report and to phone home and mm-hmm. describe what's what might be going wrong and to deal with it. Same thing in communication infrastructure, chemical plants. The financial system uses computers for just about everything. And you've got combinations of software and hardware, right? So some of these critical infrastructure situations are hardware where they have embedded devices. And one thing that I understand planners worry about a lot is so-called Trojan embedded devices, right? The idea is the people building out the whatever, I'll pick on the electricity grid because it's easy, but it could be anything. People building all these substations, they put out the tender, the various hardware they need. The low bidder comes along, and unbeknownst to them, the low bidder is actually a supplier from a foreign power with malign intentions that puts in parts which have got secret code in them, which can be activated remotely in the event that they want to shut down the power grid. Right, that's the threat model. And it's very tough to guard against, because how do you go about testing every single little chip in a complicated piece of equipment to make sure it hasn't got something nasty in it?
Mm-hmm.
So the fearful scenario is this nasty stuff can be activated long distance through the internet. Well, now I've got a situation which the owners of the power grid may have an incentive to fight against this, but they don't really know what to worry about. And the owners of the communication network may be somebody else, and they don't have the ability to sort out which traffic is going to the power station necessarily, to the substations, and filter out the traffic. That would be have the dangerous pings of death or whatever in there. The ping of death being the instruction to do to shut yourself off or do something bad or blow up or whatever.
Now,
when you multiply those, When you multiply those capabilities by the number of different people who, planners. Remember, planners are always doing threat modeling. They're always imagining the worst case.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they're thinking foreign states, foreign terrorists, domestic terrorists, foreign or domestic private parties that just want to engage in blackmailers. If you're truly paranoid, you even worry about American Spring. So now you've got all these potential threat models, right? And all these different places where it can be deployed. It's amazing they can sleep at night. And the next thing you know, you get one of these bills. Right? So the answer is, let's write a bunch of rules that will allow us to deal with all these different nightmare scenarios we've dreamed up, and which will force the people building these new great tools to build in security, to build in fallbacks, to build in something which will allow them to deal with what they think was the unexpected, but we've been lying awake at night thinking about it. And by the way, I'm probably trying to do it to other countries at the same time. So you get these rules in place. And then the theory is the president declares cyber emergency if he finds them. Here I'm quoting from the bill: actual or imminent action by any individual or entity to exploit a cyber risk in a manner that disrupts, attempts to disrupt, or poses a significant risk of disruption to the operation of the information infrastructure essential to the reliable operation of covered critical infrastructure. Now those are terms of art in the bill, and they're both pretty broad. Especially the critical infrastructure is pretty broad, because it includes things which affect our intelligence and defense functions. Affect intelligence or defense functions. So by that point, you've gotten to something that's really tremendously broad. So you're creating an authority, at least in the first versions of these bills, which if somebody wanted to abuse it, wouldn't be hard. And that's, something to worry about.
We're chatting with Professor Michael Frumkin of University of Miami School of Law on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you. There are a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU, our webpage being at kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I hope that you continue to listen to the show and to KZSU more broadly. So, Michael, with regard to these cyber emergencies, what scenarios of the range of scenarios that are possible do you see as most likely for such a power to be invoked? We know that there are a variety of hypothetical scenarios that could theoretically occur, that might occur, but in terms of the likelihood, what do you see as the scenarios that are actually a risk that would necessitate even considering this kind of legislation?
Well, I can't read president's mind, so let me answer almost the question you asked, which is which of these various horrible things I described might actually happen,
mm-hmm.
therefore needing a response of some kind, whether or not it was this kind.
Right.
I think the Trojan chip problem is quite real. I mean, we've seen examples of that already. So I think any sort of sensible national contingency planning really has to think about that. And that's a problem because, you know, that sweeps really, really broadly. I mean, we're talking about hospital equipment, financial services equipment, ordinary computers maybe, right? I mean, if you can get a Trojan chip into every PC, then, you know, if your control of them is fine-grained enough, you just deal with the ones you care about. So I think that that's a genuine issue we have to worry about. I mean, it's a hardware problem. And it's not obvious to me that, you know, in trying to control for the quality of hardware, we need to turn the internet inside out and, you know, allow people to potentially have enormous control over the entire network. But I do think the hardware problem is real enough, given what we've seen, that you have to take it seriously. I mean, the next one I'd say is the worms. Again, based just on real-life experience, right? The Stuxnet worm tells us that this is something real that people are actually working on right now. It's not science fiction. So, you know, if you're a government planner or anybody who's, you know, doing national security work, you'd be crazy not to worry about that. So I guess those would be my top two.
And I guess that, you know, getting us back to a question I opened up with, I guess I'll come back around and say, or ask, in your opinion, do legislators understand those risks? I mean, one big concern that I've had with regard to SOPA and PIPA, and about which I've written, is what appears to be not only a fundamental misunderstanding of the technology, but in fact a willingness to be willfully ignorant and to chuckle about not using email or not knowing what these nerds are talking about. Is this situation any different?
I think it is different, actually. Mm-hmm. The SOPA PIPA stuff, as I understand it, remember I live in the southern tip of Florida, where it's very beautiful, but we're also a very long way from the Beltway. So my knowledge of these things is a little remote sometimes. My understanding is SOPA and PIPA are really driven by interests of the content creation industries. Mm-hmm. And the chuckling you're talking about deals with claims that, you know, people like you and me made about what it would do to the technology of the internet and other uses. The dynamic in these national security things is almost exactly the opposite, in that my understanding of what happens is, you know, somebody from the Defense Department, or what we fondly call a three-letter agency, goes to Congress and does a secure briefing and scares the pants off everybody. And then the problem isn't what they're not informed about is not the risk. What they're not well informed about is the extent to which there's not a risk, or the extent to which there are limits on the risk, or the risk isn't in fact real, and they tend to go overboard as a result. Mm-hmm. So I think the dynamic is very different because, you know, by the time the National Security Association is done scaring people with beautiful charts and scary stories that are all conveniently classified, it's very tough to make arguments that, you know, we're not all going to go, you know, and become slaves to, you know, somebody controlling your internet next week.
The one I think both very troublesome but also prominent feature of this legislation, and as you mentioned in your synopsis, is that the decision itself to invoke the cyber emergency is unreviewable. So how does the Act define a cyber emergency such that these powers could then be invoked? And what are your thoughts on whether the unreviewability of those decisions is a good idea or should be changed, assuming this law were to go forward?
Well, I think it's absolutely, as I look at the structure of this thing, I really don't see why they feel they need that, why it has to be unreviewable. Given how deferential courts generally are in national security matters anyway, I don't really see, it seems to me that this is a terrible idea, but if they get rid of it, it isn't going to make that big a difference anyway, except avoiding setting a terrible precedent. Because this is an area where courts, I mean, if, you know, the president actually does, you know, does create this in the face of some sort of genuine danger, the courts are going to run away from this as fast as they can. And the reason you want judicial review is the president does it when there isn't actually a genuine danger. And then that's the one time you really do want judicial review. So I would have, I mean, maybe I'm being a little idealistic here, but I would have thought that was something that actually they could jettison pretty easily. And I don't know who put that in and why. But it does not seem to me to be in any way necessary to the general structure of this act. Now, currently, and here there's room at least for fine-tuning, if not drastic pairing. The numbers of things that can trigger this authority are really very capacious. The president's given this authority to declare this state of emergency. I quoted some of the language before, right? The actual imminent action stuff. And if there's any risk, basically, any imminent risk, any threat of risk to any system whose disruption of destruction would cause a mass casualty event, well, fair enough, right? Severe economic consequences, what's that mean? Mass evacuations, again, that sounds good. Or any of these severe degradations of national security capabilities, including intelligence and defense functions. And now I'm thinking, well, would that include publishing the Pentagon Papers?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is those lists, it's an or, right? Any one of those things is enough. You don't need them all. Now, the to be fair, the drafts of the Act do have various sections which try to talk about First Amendment values in different kinds of ways. Indeed, the most one of the more recent versions has a special declaration up front that says nothing in this act gives the president the authority to turn off the internet, because obviously they heard from the critics and were trying to respond to it. But that's not really the point, right? The point is that it would give the president, pursuant to previously crafted regulations by this agency, the authority to require private participants in the information infrastructure to do whatever was in those secret plans.
So if we're talking about the cyber emergency, and we're talking about kill switch, right? The idea of shutting this technology down. As I mentioned in the introduction, as many listeners knew already, and anyone paying attention to these issues knows, we've seen governments in the last year or two attempt this, some successfully and some not. Is it possible, assuming all of this happened, is it possible to actually kill the technology, to kill the internet, if you will, in the United States?
I ran a panel on that very question of computers, freedom, and privacy almost, 10 years ago now. And one guy said, give me a backhoe, in four different places, and I'll kill the internet.
Hmm.
Certainly there are some choke points where even if you're not totally taking it out, you can very significantly degrade it. Of course, the more fiber we put down, the more it may be that takes more work to do that. More fundamentally, it seems to me there's a number of different access points where the idea, I suspect, here is not, in fact, to kill the internet in the sense of turning it off. It's rather to shape it, to control pieces of it in one of these so-called emergency situations. So, what the obvious place I would think any place to go regulate is the backbone. That's what the backhoe idea was about, the place where, the big pipes where all the traffic goes. What's interesting is, in the only sort of Senate report we've had on this so far, they absolutely disclaim that that's what they want to do, that they're talking about people who connect to the backbone. Well, this supports the hypothesis that it's about getting people to invest in security and to deal with government-approved threat models. And that means the targets are going to be ISPs, cell phone providers, landline telephony, all the rest, the people, the major players in communications infrastructure, and maybe also application providers, be it in the cloud or major intermediaries like Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and probably more of the infrastructure people, right, the people who run the electricity grid and the people who run the cell phones and the ISPs. That, is a pretty large regulatory target, but it is certainly not so numerous that it's impossible to regulate them. So I think this is practicable from the point of view of the government trying to do this, if that's what you're asking. But I think what they're going for exactly is they don't want to be in a position where they have to do what the Egyptians did, right? The Egyptians flipped a very small number of switches to basically disconnect the country, right? There was a small number of key players in the Egyptian communications environment who controlled internet and telephone traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically pulled the plug on them, or told them to pull the plug themselves. I think the idea here is to do things which might not even be noticed. Remember, I don't think I mentioned this, but the presidential declaration is to be reported to Congress, but it doesn't necessarily have to be reported to the public. So you could get one of these cyber emergency declarations, and in theory, we would never know. As I went through this and tried to imagine what I would do if I were a government planner,
right,
trying to deal with these various threats I came up with, one thing kept coming back to me, right? So let's go back to the Pinga Def and the Trojan hardware. right? So this imagined scenario is sometime in the past, some nasty power, perhaps foreign, managed to embed this dangerous Trojan hardware in critical infrastructure of some kind, be it hospitals, telecoms, power grid, whatever. And now we learn through intelligence sources, or we have to start doing it. They're sending pings that activate whatever power they built into the back door of these things. And we want to stop that. How are we going to do that? Well, we have to have a way to actually identify those packets and block them and not block all the other traffic that we don't want to block, whether it's your and my emails or the legitimate control information that's going back and forth across the network to make the power grid work or whatever. It seems to me that the only way I can think of having that capability is to do what's called deep packet inspection, something I imagine a lot of your listeners know what it is. But the idea is that the people who are carrying the traffic will look beyond the headers of the packets of data they're carrying to get some sense of the nature of the content and how much varies with implementation. But it seems to me that if you are an agency trying to achieve protection against all, you know, many, maybe not all, but many of the kind of threats I hypothesize. And again, I'm just, you know, sitting here in my office trying to dream up what teams of analysts in Washington, the Pentagon, the NSA, and other places have probably done a more thorough job of. I hope so, but we pay them. Then the thing that comes closest to a silver bullet that hits the most number of things is deep packet inspection. You really want to know what you're trying to block, and then you can try to block it. But anything else becomes such a broad brush approach that it starts to interfere with traffic you don't want to block, which is also harmful to you, and it gives your attacker power over you. If your attacker can force you to damage yourself by shutting down your networks, that's a successful attack in a different kind of a way. So you want to deny them that capability as well. And it seems to me, therefore, that the tool that if I'm a government planner, not that anybody's ever likely to put me in charge of this stuff, but if the tool I want is deep packet inspection, because that gives me the power then to do the fine-grained things I need to do to block whatever the bad things are I'm able to identify. And deep packet inspection has all kinds of heavy freight, because now we're talking content. Now we're putting the government in the business of actually monitoring the content of everything, because the only way you can tell what's the good stuff and the bad stuff is to look at everything and then sort.
We're chatting with Professor Michael Frumkin, University of Miami School of Law, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Michael, we're at about the unfair portion of the show. I call it the unfair portion of the show because I start asking questions that you may not have adequate time to answer with the luxury that we've had thus far. And so I attempt to tailor the questions, but nonetheless, time can play a role.
There's no prize at the end?
There's no prize. I mean, I will tell you that most guests are able to negotiate this fairly well, but no, there's other than the pleasure of having been on the show and sharing your ideas, nothing else really comes of it. But I give it as a disclosure anyway, as opposed to declaring a secret cyber emergency. I'm declaring an emergency up front for all to hear. But that gets really to that idea of transparency, which I do want to touch on, and kind of think at a top level about where these bills are. You mentioned that the president can declare a cyber emergency and the public not be aware of it.
Again, I want to emphasize, these are draft bills.
I understand. And I appreciate that. So this isn't the law. Right. And that's certainly worth repeating for those that might be tuning in late.
Don't panic yet.
And that was really where I was asking earlier. I mean, you've mentioned that the bill, as far as you know, is sitting but could be attached to something else, as is often the case. But with regard to the issue of transparency, I'm curious to get your perspective, particularly on that, because I could envision, right, a policymaker saying, well, of course the president, right, should be allowed, okay, to make a declaration, issue such an order, and for these, particular powers to be invoked precisely because, right, if the public knew of the threat, there'd be panic, there'd be concern, and not to mention, it might tip off the entities or individuals involved in the potential attack, and wouldn't we want to go after them directly without giving them more information? Your response?
Well, I think we have to make a bunch of distinctions. I'm sorry, that's what lawyers do.
Mm-hmm.
The first is, do we need to publicize the contingency plans, right, the regulations that the agency has come up with? And it seems to me that's where the case for secrecy is strongest, that's also where, in some sense, you know, you want to know at least the nature of the kinds of powers that the government proposes to be able to deploy. And on the other hand, the powers are precisely what they don't want to tell the potential attacker. So we have a very tough problem there. And where there are really genuinely good arguments on both sides, I think. And that's one set of problems. But as for the declaration of emergency, I do think that that has to become public at some point. That's my own personal opinion. That the fact that it occurred has to become public. Maybe not immediately. Maybe you give it a delay period. But, you know, 20 days or something. I don't know. But it has to become. People have a right to know that. That the country is being attacked. That the country is responding in some way. I think that we absolutely have a right to know that. The other thing is, I mean, my answer could change depending on what was the panoply of powers that these plans could have, right? So I have a different, if they're going to start doing deep packet inspection, scanning every packet that everybody, you know, goes in and out of the country, that seems to me to be pretty serious stuff. We absolutely have to know about that and real soon. Depending on what other sets of powers they intend to invoke, it may, you know, disclosure may be more or less appropriate. So I'm not necessarily a one-size-fits-all guy on this. This is why I get so nervous, because the place where it seems most logical to have the secrecy on the one hand is the contingency plans. But it's also the place where having the secrecy makes it most difficult to make rational judgments about everything downstream.
Mm-hmm.
So those things are really connected. It's kind of like a seesaw. If there was, you know, there was some way for the government to produce a laundry list of the kinds of powers that it might use without being very specific, and then say we're not doing anything else, then we'd know how much disclosure was required. But I think even that level of disclosure would probably make a rational planner pretty itchy. So it's a really tough problem. I mean, if we could trust Congress to do serious oversight in camera, in secret, that might be another solution. But nothing I've seen in the past decade gives me any confidence in that theory.
Right. And that really is a good way, as we have about 5 minutes left, to consider where we're going. It seems, at least, and this is my own perspective, that the, you know, through SOPA and PIPA, through the actions over, you know, last week involving Mega Upload, which I recognize is not a traditional national security threat, although piracy, that is copyright.
Yeah, I really think that that's a different animal from this.
Well, yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, which is where I'm headed. You know, that scenario involves copyright piracy, and it would seem at first blush that there may be a relationship between those kinds of threats and the kind of threats that the kill switch legislation attempts to address. But yeah, exactly. What is your reaction there?
Here's the potential connection.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we are all familiar with the term function creep. So imagine they get this up and running. And after a few years, they've actually got their contingency plans in place. Now you're going to have a system which is going to be really tempting for the people trying to do the copyright policing to say, well, let's just piggyback on this other system that's functioning. So, you know, you build this, there's a real danger it expands.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a political problem, not a technical one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the technical problem is a packet's a packet. Until you open it up, you don't know what it is. Is it, you know, copyrighted material or instructions to a substation to blow itself up or turn itself off or something?
So I'm not going to ask you the crystal ball question because I tend to avoid those, but I will ask you this. Would you be surprised, or how would you, I guess I'm going to put it another way, a better question. Over the next 6 months, you know, as Congress is reconvening and confronting these issues, would you be surprised to see these bills be resurrected, as it were, become non-dormant and become law over the next year? I'm not asking you for your prediction whether it will.
I wouldn't be the least bit surprised to see an amended version of this get revived. I mean, I would be a little bit disappointed and surprised if they kept the unreviewable stuff in there, which I don't know if that's just put in as a bargaining chip so they can take it out or what that is. I mean, that just strikes me as going way beyond what's necessary or sensible, even in my best attempts to put myself in their shoes. But, you know, a slightly tidied up, cleaned up version of this, it's all too easy to see it being revived.
Michael Frumkin, professor of law at University of Miami School of Law. Thank you for joining us on the show. I'm going to ask you the last question, which is just to talk about what you're currently working on. And for those people that want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
Well, my papers are all online at law.tm, which is my personal website. So that's the place to go. I also have a blog I run, you were kind enough to mention, called discourse.net. But I mostly blog about things that I don't intend to write deeply about. It's more of a political than an academic blog. Mm-hmm. And if I'm plugging stuff, I should plug the online law journal I edit, which is called Jotwell, the Journal of Things We Like Lots, which are reviews of the best recent legal scholarship in a number of areas. So what I'm working on in the future is, first of all, keeping Jotwell going as a full-time enterprise. Second, I've gotten really interested in the regulation of identity. Hmm. So, you know, both corporate and government structures, systems that allow other people to build a picture of you for their purposes. So we've got a situation where we have not just physical ID cards, but virtual ID cards, virtual dossiers, and these creation of these databases gives people power over us. And I mentioned how those are constructed and how that power is or could be exercised. And I've been collecting a phenomenal amount of material on this, which I'm still trying to assimilate in the hopes of putting it together for maybe even a book. I don't know. It's a fascinating subject. It's got so many different pieces. It's keeping me busy and interested.
Well, I'll tell you, that is a perfect way to close, because clearly if these bills do come to life, I want to invite you back on the show. But also, as that project, which I recognize you're just still conceiving, develops in the future, I'd love to have you on the show. But regardless, thank you for being on the show today and bring us up to speed on these bills, which I think are indicative of a lot of where policy is or is heading with regard to technology. And so these issues are not going to go away. But I appreciate you taking the time to educate my listeners, and I look forward to having you on the show down the road.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm thrilled to mention and the upcoming guests on the show. Hearsay Culture, it has moved to a new time in the history of the show. It's on Fridays at noon Pacific time on KZSU Stanford. After this show, airing on January 27th, I'm looking forward to having on Professor George Contreras of American University Washington College of Law, Professor Dan Margoxi of Hunter College, co-author of States of Secrecy, a forthcoming volume of the British Journal of the History of Science, Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School, author of Orwell's Armchair, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law School, discussing her article, Illuminating Innovation. Professor Jennifer Holt of the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of the book Empires of Entertainment, a really interesting history of the entertainment industry from the 80s through the mid-90s. Professor Julie Cohen of Georgetown Law, author of the new book, Configuring the Network Self. Professor Hamilton Bean of the University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information and the Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence. And rounding out the quarter, I'm looking forward to chatting with Baron Zocca of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. The main way to listen, as I mentioned, is live on KZSU, Fridays from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time. But if you are not tuning in at that time, you can listen via podcast, and there are several ways to pick up the KZSU podcast, the Hearsay Culture podcast. You can pick it up by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 150-plus shows, as well as see the upcoming schedule. You can also get the show by going to iTunes and subscribing to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's feed, where you will not just get Hearsay Culture, but any other events occurring at CIS. And you can also get the show by going to the webpage for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and that's cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I had a cold, which I fought over the course of the last 2 months, but I also had an extremely busy fall semester with writing and tenure applications and a variety of other things that I was up to. As a result, I have a more open spring schedule, and again, the winter quarter on KZSU runs through March, and then the spring schedule will begin in April. So whereas in the past I would have had several guest books, at least probably half of the guests booked even at this point, I am more open at this point because, frankly, I haven't extended as many invitations because I haven't had as much time to focus on extending them. The result is it's a good opportunity for you and any listeners to give me suggestions on guests you'd like to see on the show. And in fact, several guests I've had on over the last year have come as a direct result of suggestions from listeners. So if you have any suggestions for guests you think should be on Hearsay Culture, I welcome your emails at dave@hearsayculture.com. You can also offer me any other feedback or suggestions or comments or criticisms or praise that you'd like to offer. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. Also, I'm going to be, this busy year continues, and I'm going to be on the road at a number of conferences over the next few months, and I'll post that schedule as well. To the extent that you're going to be in those areas, I would love to meet you and have the opportunity to get your feedback directly. So again, it's dave@hearsayculture.com. Meanwhile, I will say thank you for listening to this inaugural winter 2012 session of Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.